Didn't we kind of picture this the Spock walk as Spock on ice? The music.
No, it was the cloud. You always said that about the cloud cue. Spock on ice. The cue called the cloud.
Just evoked a different image.
Again, there's some reaction shots here, like that one of Majel, really good. That one of McCoy, that wasn't in the original. It's stayed on a wide shot. And as this process evolved, Bob really saw, no, we needed the people. We needed to focus on the people.
I don't recall seeing that headgear in the Christie's auction.
Wonder where it went.
Sinead O'Connor keeps it.
Probably.
But it's an awfully pretty
Again, all those
mechanism.
wonderful percussion implements that Jerry put in here, the water phones, and
Right. One that sounds like a rusty gate.
yes, uh-huh. It's the Super Bowl, I think, is in here. And of course, the beam is always with anything to do with the V'ger and the Ilia probe is there.
I really miss Jerry. Miss his
Great
scores.
man,
He was
really great.
amazingly inventive.
And there's also anything to do with Spock has that distant native percussion. I highly doubt that Jerry sat and watched episodes of the old series, but somehow or other he got that. He got that Spock came from an ancient civilization that probably had some violence in its past. So you hear, like, just it could be an innocuous thing like Spock sitting at his station talking,
But it's like
and in the
echoes of
background
violence.
this
Primitive.
distant primitive drums in somewhere in the distant past. We took out here
The
the
instructions.
thruster suit audio instruction manual. We figured that of all people, Spock would know how to run one. And again, it was that we stop to deal with technology so much in this original script, and it was a very cool idea at the time. But when Bob looked at this film, he saw that that was wrong. And if he had previewed it in 1979, he would have seen that that was wrong. That the technology is V'ger, and if you're dealing, the people are dealing with each other, our main family of characters, it has to be focused on their relationships and what's going on in their own minds. I think this is also, as I said earlier, this is probably the only science fiction movie about going out into space that's actually about going inside things.
Right.
And again, that. What it's about is we're getting inside your own mind. We're getting inside the human psyche here, and these people are going to have to get inside their own brains and figure out what is wrong with them. And really, what is wrong with them is that they need each other.
This is the beginning of the Spock walk sequence that was originally going to be quite different in the original script, and they had shot some of it when Kirk and Spock were originally going to go out together and explore the interior of V'ger.
The memory wall.
As a quick point of before you continue, Darren, sorry
mention
to
this
interrupt,
change is coming
is
up here.
that again to heighten the jeopardy that people felt in the picture, this orifice opens and it used to just sit there as Spock goes through. And one of the last changes that our team were able to get was to have it close just right behind him.
Right. It obviously needed to be there. It obviously was a still photo in the beginning, in the original version. It needed to be there. It was one of those things that they just had to let go. Now, again, it's like Spock is going on this incredible odyssey. It is very evocative of 2001. Again, this is a lot of Trumbull influence here because he's the one that came in and suggested that, you know what, this memory wall sequence doesn't work. It's boring. It's dull. It's not engaging in any way.
Trumbull actually was brought on at around the time that they were actually shooting the memory wall sequence.
Right.
And Trumbull was realizing that this isn't going to work. Even you have a marvelous set and interesting things, but in the end, it's going to look like two guys hanging on wires.
And there was
And it
nowhere for them
did.
to really go, and no other way to shoot it because it was shot, designed so
You had basically one angle,
two-dimensionally
yeah.
that there was only one angle to shoot the whole thing in.
But again, he employed this fantastic concept of first-person cinema,
I mean,
where
look at this sequence, prior to computers. That you could film
it's astounding.
An amazing sequence that looks like
And it
this.
makes my head ache thinking about the optical work that they had to wait through all the lab work to get and see what they had.
A lot of this work is actually Robert McCall illustrations that were put on the animation stand.
That's right.
like this one. Actually, that the center, the space lips, as it was called, was an actual physical model that they made.
And didn't we find that too?
Yes, we found
it,
that.
It also, shall I say, has some sexual overtones to it.
And there's the often comment about it being Miss Piggy noticeable in there, and it's not.
Or Darth Vader, all kinds of...
It was just coincidental.
It just shows you how abstract images will let people see what they want to see.
But you see, this is, on the surface, about Spock going inside V'ger and finding out what's in there. But this is actually a journey into his own mind to figure out what's going on with him. And once in there, he realizes that subconsciously, now it's going to be externalized, what's missing, what he needs to do is to make this touch. So he's going to reach out and touch this sensor that represents V'ger. And what happens? He doesn't want to connect it. He backs away. He's thrown away from it.
And interestingly, Ilea, being the most arguably passionate character, right, even though Starfleet has forced her to not be.
But you see, that's why that scene where she heals Chekhov is so important.
Right. It's this, the most passionate character being combined with the most dispassionate being of V'ger makes an interesting combination, and it's very full of symbolism.
And once again, it's like you could very easily scan for... somebody coming through that orifice and then beaming them in. And that might have been practical, but I mean, this idea of Kirk getting in and going into this vacuum chamber after his friend, I mean, that's what Star Trek is all about. And that it was those kind of moments that you needed to find everyone you could and play them up.
The other problem with that sequence was the that was one of the reasons why Bob didn't like the special longer version, is that they originally had this extended sequence of Kirk leaving the Enterprise before going to see Spock, which again just lengthened the whole sequence of him going into this spacesuit. I have to go out and I have to get him, and he goes
outside.
The
idea of him and you see him, going was good.
Right. You see him leaving the ship, then only for Spock to show up, but the spacesuit that he was wearing was from the memory wall sequence.
Right, it didn't match.
So it's like, while he's out in space, he would have had to have changed suits, so it didn't match for continuity.
Not to mention that they put in, as part of that scene on television and on videotape, the plate for what needed to have a matte painting of the Enterprise saucer around it that was never done. So
and it's funny, for the scenes that we transferred that and put them on the second disc, you can see all the scaffolds.
Right, you saw the people walking into the commissary, practically. Yeah.
And the reason that they changed the design of the spaceships was so that we could see the reflection of all this happening around Spock on Spock's, when we're still looking at Spock's face.
I remember that you and I, Darren, were talking about completing the mat on the shot.
That matte shot of Kirk coming out of and leaking it
as, but you know, at least leaking it out as here's one of the additional shots from the director's edition. But we realized that would have been, it would have been something that could have really backfired instead of something that would have been fun. It could have been something that can say, well, these guys, you know, the people who are putting this thing together don't realize that he's wearing the wrong spacesuit, or that they would get the expectations to be that, oh, the memory wall is going to be back. And there was never a plan for the memory wall to be back. It didn't work. It wasn't going back. But we just didn't feel that was, you know, while it was a fun idea, and I know you rendered it.
Right there. They're one of the most important moments in this film and in all of Star Trek, where Spock says, I was wrong. I should have known. I was looking for logic and unemotion. But you know what? I was wrong. This is what it's all about. Just brilliant, simple scene. We took out also another incident of Kirk snapping, biting McCoy's head off there. And of stating the obvious, you know, Kirk had a line there, what questions? Well, it was better to have Spock just continue his monologue. And the tail of this scene had him summarizing.
Right.
A machine planet sending a machine to Earth looking for its creator. You know, and it, again, to make sure that the audience understood what was going on. But when we viewed this with Bob, he says, don't we know that already?
Mm-hmm.
I said, do you think so? He says, yes, take it out.
More great examples of the split diopter.
Yes.
Yeah, which allows you to have two focal planes in one shot on a widescreen image like this. And it was necessary because of how cramped it was on the sets.
Here's our first look at the full exterior of V'ger. And this was done by, started on by Steve Berg at Foundation at the time. And he did a lot of research and found Sid Mead's designs for V'ger, and I think really nailed it. And John Teska took over the shots of it later on.
That was the one shot. I mean, that was the shot that we needed in this film. We looked at many, many, many different passes of it, right? That was, if there was one that we obsessed over, mm-hmm. it was probably that,
yeah,
to
that
get
the
it,
one that had the
it
most
just right.
Too much smoke, not enough smoke,
the movement,
density,
the, where the earth is, I mean, everything,
small,
it had
yeah.
to sell. And when we premiered this at the Paramount Theater on the lot, everybody applauded. And so I think we did what we set out to do. But they didn't have that originally, and
you never really
understood the geography of what was going on. That the cloud had dissipated, revealing this enormous vessel orbiting Earth. You get a graphic there that represents it, which always reminded me kind of the RKO logo from the old films, a lot of which Bob Wise made. And what they ended up with was just cutting some shots, repeating some shots from other portions of the movie.
This was another sequence where sound was going to play a major role. We were talking, you know, Bob was saying that part of the other reason that in watching the film is that V'ger wasn't as threatening, and we needed to present this powerful threat in sound as much as in picture. And so when we were dealing with this, I said to Chuck, really make it feel like this remarkable, powerful energy comes from way behind you and goes, right over the
Spock
the
even says that those balls of energy are hundreds of times more powerful than what attacked the ships.
Mm-hmm.
So we needed to get that sense. Plus, do you remember we found fully executed color paintings of those exact angles
Gorgeous.
Of V'ger, which they had filmed for the
yes.
purpose of cutting into the picture for a preview that never happened. So all we did was create those exact angles, exactly as they were painted and planned.
What's funny is that the only shot that we pretty much did for the film that wasn't used was a shot of the balls over the Earth going into position.
Right. It was the entire Earth surrounded by these energy weapons.
We actually, a few years ago, gave the shot to StarTrek.com. So they have you'll be able to see that shot if you go online, and you should be able to see that.
I think there are also alternate versions of the
rack focus,
right? The Enterprise reflection in the travel pod window.
Mm-hmm.
So now, I think the end result, which really the rhythm and the feeling of the movie has not changed at all, but what has happened is that you now understand exactly what's going on, and that is what Bob was going for, what he inspired in us. You know, we sat and watched the picture several times with him and made all of our notes about what he wanted in the to see what we could do. And then he basically let us do it and looked at everything. And he did have some opinions where he told us put it back the way it was, or ideas of his own, or to change things. But again, the goal was to not make you suddenly feel like you are seeing a different movie than you remember seeing. And I'm sorry to say that fate has befallen a number of science fiction films from this era that we don't need to specifically name at the moment. You probably know what they are. But in the case of all of them, they were all hugely successful films and didn't need to really be messed with at all. But nobody was standing on a pedestal rallying for the cause of the 1979 version of this movie. It was very, very obvious that it was unfinished, that the raw material was all there. It simply needed the normal amount of time, the normal amount of work that every film usually gets and always deserves.
The greatest compliment that I feel that we've received from this picture is when people say that they've seen the film and they didn't really notice anything different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want people to say, oh, I love that one shot, it was great. That means we failed or didn't, you know. When it's so seamless that you don't know that there are a thousand edits in this project, Sometimes we had to pull one frame.
And I think over 90 shots that were in some way altered in terms of effects.
Sort of. Over 100.
Right.
That when you do that much work and no one notices it, it's that's the compliment I want. That's what means you did your job. Instead of the constant reviews of, oh, did you see that great new whatever? No, that's not the way it works.
This was a moment where I specifically remember being on the mixing stage with Chuck Michael. Yeah. And doing this scene, this reel
that
day.
Such a great job.
And I'm like, wow, this whole thing has just come to life, and I just feel like we're all going to be blown to smithereens any second. Yeah.
And it's good to hear the feedback of people who have given this movie a second look, and you know, looked at it 20 years later and said, you know, this is better than I remembered it, and I really understand it now, mm-hmm. or I really mm-hmm. enjoy it a lot more than I did when
but
I was
But I can't
younger.
Tell you what's different.
Right.
Now, also,
or, you know, I don't remember it being as good as it was.
We mentioned earlier about the sound work, the sound design, particularly for the bridge, which we built too gradually. When you first got, so everybody scrambling around trying to get the thing going, it was almost no noise. When it was the scene where Ilea comes on, there was a few things going. And then when they got underway, you had the full level of sound. And now here, where Kirk gives the order to shut everything down and put everything on automatic, we gradually dropped the sound of the bridge out. So you have this contrast, whereas in the original version, you didn't have that at all. It was always the same. It was this kind of low hiss of room tone, and that was it.
I always, it gives us someplace to go, sound-wise, audibly.
Mm-hmm. And you see that everything is off behind her. I think we kept in a very quiet beep of an automated system working. And then as they come back onto the bridge and resume their stations, you gradually can now hear them all coming on. People press buttons and something happens. Even though in reality, you know, we all use computers now. We don't have a beep for every button we press. Nothing beeps.
I do.
You do? Well, Darren, that's you. That's why you did this thing.
Right.
Because you knew that, so. But you see, you're watching, you know, it's like why every time you look at somebody asleep in a movie or a TV show, they're snoring. Why? Because you visually understand that they're sleeping, they're not dead. So that's why you need the beeps when you hit panels in science fiction movies.
It's funny, the other interesting comment that I remember from one of the reviews when Director's Edition came out was that they even made the uniforms better. And I was stopped and I started thinking, what does this person mean? And it just, what I think it was that without any sound on the bridge, as dead as it was, it left you just looking around for something to, you know, experience. And there was so many shots of just people standing around that were heightened.
Here's our big overhaul of the last act, where we go into the inner chamber that Spock has been in before. But now we see, I guess, all the imagery is turned off, and we see its actual interior. And this was intended to show things in there before, and we had boards for it, and we had to do a little bit of design work to flesh out what hadn't actually been created for it. But I think it's a nice bridging in between the final confrontation at the island to this transference into the inner chamber.
There was an earlier version that we were talking about early on with Bob that we just ended up going with this and loved this. This is the final result. That the orifice opens and it was going to be space. It looked like it was space, almost like you were going into that secondary section and everything was still on. And then when you finally pull through there, it's almost like they were either being released or being put into that extra section. And when they pull closer, the stars that were out there were going to start moving, and they would start building, they would come out to be the blocks that would build the bridge. It was just something that was early on that we were discussing with Bob of an idea, and I always really liked the idea of the illusion that they were going into this next space.
Right.
And, or into some new hologram.
I think going with what the storyboards were, I think was the way to go, even though there were many versions of that. That had, again, later on you'll see these lightning bolts that are coming around where the Enterprise ultimately comes to rest. And one idea was that those bolts would illuminate all this massive machinery mm-hmm. of this chamber, but it felt bigger keeping it black. This sequence was put back in, very important one. Two very important things happen here. One is Kirk ordering the self-destruct to be on standby in case they fail, to take V'ger with them. And the other was the Spock weeping scene, which was improvised into the script by Leonard Nimoy, actually, because he realized that, again, the main theme, what this story really was about, was not on paper, and it needed to be stated. It needed to be in there. So we track around the bridge here to, you know, each of our characters, and then finally end up on Spock, and then get this extraordinary moment where Spock weeps, and he explains really what's going on in the film. I loved a little bit earlier also, while Kirk was ordering the self-destruct, the exchange of glances between him and Steve Collins as Decker. Their relationship, you know, the rift has been repaired there. Nothing specifically happened to bring that about, but it's probably just Spock's presence that gradual build-up of this camaraderie and working together and all finding their destiny once again. They become themselves again.
Right, and they're all settling into their purpose.
Even though they're facing death right in the face.
Right.
You know, they're becoming complete people again.
It was all of them coming together like they originally did.
Right.
Which launched the movie series.
Right. Because we got things back to where they needed to be. Kirk and crew on the Enterprise.
And made us want to see more.
But I think the insert also that was added of the Enterprise going through the innards, that passageway into this chamber that they're getting towards now, was put in right at the spot where it needed to be, because right where Scotty said, yes, V'ger, we'll take V'ger with us, we now actually see that they're in the midst of this vessel, and the matter-antimatter explosion is just going to take it all with it.
I love that something we haven't actually said yet is that shot, which I believe Steve Berg designed, was mm-hmm. that, right? When we were cutting this film, the way that the film looked and the fact that it's an epic picture, the way your eye registers something when it's big versus a video screen is very different. So we had set up a projector at Paramount to our editing system when we were editing with the entire film on the wall, to make sure that scale was not going to be betrayed as we were doing it, and the timing would not be betrayed for the epic film. And what I really love about that shot of the Enterprise going through the inner operings of V'ger is that nowadays you'd have a much bigger shot of the ship, but that stayed with the massive scale.
Because at the scale we were looking at it, we could see it.
Right, and pulling back still kept it the epic scale of the entire picture, even though that was a completely new shot.
This was great. I mean, Bob Wise's collection is at USC and at the Cinema Television Library, run by our friend Ned Comstock. And when we first were talking about this and went down there and looked through all of this and found the storyboards for this wing walk sequence, as it was officially called, we were astounded, because in the 79 version, it looks like they just sort of pull up to a soundstage, right, mm-hmm. and yeah. stop, and you actually hear a clunk of them pulling up. And then they just kind of get out there, and in some very hastily executed matte paintings, do this walk across these hexagonal tiles. But now, based on original storyboards, you see V'ger's brain complex island sort of floating there, with the sort of Stonehenge-like structures coming up out of it. And you see V'ger forming these hexagonal blocks as a bridge to the Enterprise. All done based on the original storyboards in CG, including the little people coming up through the hatch there and getting into the position that they need to be in for the live-action shots. And then we have shots of them walking across that we went back to the original blue screen plates, correct?
Yes, mm-hmm. and those
little low-angle shots.
Those little right. lights that come in, we actually animated on twos so that it would look like it was shot on an animation stand, and we didn't put any motion blur in it, we didn't put anything like that, just to make it look like a shot that was done in 79.
Right. right. And then I also believe that we had, was it these lightning bolts, were they done with a Tesla coil? Or,
well, they were originally done with the tensor coil. Then weren't they scanned?
Well, but
the
I'm
original
saying,
film
yeah,
that
right.
we found, Mark, right, Darren?
I'm saying we found the original film that of these lightning bolts. These weren't just animated things put
these
in.
These were not recreated. You know,
these were the actual lightning bolts done in 78, 79, yeah. and then when we needed to recomposite them into the film. You're looking at the original lightning. See, and this is what it becomes all about, this entire journey across space and through this cloud and into this vessel. And what does it come down to? It comes, you know, down to this tiny little thing with a wire that's not connected. And see right there, that lightning behind there was not there originally. It was put
I think
in.
A lot of modern-day game shows owe a lot to the design of this set.
I would say so. Mm-hmm. You are the weakest link. There again, that lightning was put in. So you'd never notice it. You'd never know it. I mean, it just, you'd have to compare the two versions of the film frame by frame, but those little things.
Which we've done.
we three have, yes. But this was a treacherous set. People kept falling through it. And there you have Ilia and V'ger. Decker seeing the two of them. Can I tell them apart or can I not? Is this really the woman I once loved or is this part of this machine? And, of course, it has to be Kirk, has to be Captain Kirk, you know, who has taken this entire journey up to a couple of letters that are scarred over. And that has led to that question of, who am I? You know, what is my role in the universe? And that's what all these characters are asking themselves. Harold Livingston, the screenwriter of this very witty, acerbic guy, I'm sure he would love... to have had the time to flesh that concept out some more. Whether it really would have happened is another story, but it's there. That's really the movie that's inside all this, is you know, finding out what part of you is covered with dirt that you can't see, that you need to reveal to figure out who you are. Jerry Goldsmith's son, Joel Goldsmith, who is a composer himself and wrote a lot of the Borg-related cues for Star Trek First Contact, did the what essentially is this voice of V'ger. And right there, I think it was telling us that the coffee was ready. But again, a very interesting sound. It's mechanical, yet it's organic. It's not altogether different in concept from R2-D2 and the Star Wars sound designer's Ben Burtt's efforts to have that combination of organic and technological together, where you can't really tell where one began, one ended.
It's interesting that the kinetic lighting that's underneath the set that you can see showing the coalescing patterns of light.
That's used in engineering, too.
Was also used in engineering, and they brought back that the people who did that for Voyager for their engine room as well.
With a bit more color. As a matter of fact, it was the same exact device, wasn't it, Darren?
I believe so.
They actually recycled the motion picture one?
I think so.
And also, I mean, that was like the first time this movie was where we saw an actual warp engine core. It with this became standard on Star Trek every time we saw a starship.
Actually,
and basically, the engineering core, the warp core was basically in the same spot, right?
It was the same spot, using a lot of the same set pieces,
for
just
every,
rearranged.
Every incarnation of Star Trek.
Since this movie, up until the end of Enterprise, those sets were all used for Star Trek since, you know, 20-some-odd years. In the interim, that was always a Star Trek project.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the lighting changes here, you know, as V'ger comes closer to realizing what it needs. We go a little bit warmer here, a little bit while we're going to go into a magenta, and then finally into a complete red. It's pure classic science fiction. The kind of set they're in, the sound work, the way the lighting changes, the music cue that Jerry's humming away with under this thing. This is classic science fiction. And Bob was really good at this. He did every genre well. You know, when you just look at the three sci-fi movies he did, Day the Earth Stood Still and The Andromeda Strain and this, there's that simplicity and that sense of never straying too far from really what the conventions of the genre are and doing it really well in an almost definitive way, dare I say.
And Gene was a very big fan of Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yes.
So he was totally honored and thrilled to have Bob do this picture.
See, and Bob, very talented guy, but not a really emotional guy. In a way, he was a lot like Spock. And his movies are not full of gushing. There's never any really, never even any gushing romantic things in almost any film that he did. Even West Side Story, The Sound of Music, his musicals, it was always restrained. He backed off on that as much as possible and just told the story. So it's interesting that in this movie, they're all so detached. And for me, that idea that they need to come together, they need to share emotions with each other, comes through, but it comes through in a very Robert Wise kind of way. See, and there you come to what it's all about. It's not about just give me some numbers, right? Star Trek was never about just give me the numbers. It's about who we are, who we're connecting with, who we are as people.
Bob's such a master when it comes to just her stepping forward with...
Yes, uh-huh.
Creator Must Want to Join with VG, you just feel it.
She senses who among this group is also incomplete right now. You see, Decker has had his ship taken away. He's had his former love come into his life and then...
Taken away
and turned into a machine. You know, what is his destiny? Kirk and Spock and McCoy all belong with each other. They belong on the Enterprise.
And here's the physical symbol of broken connection.
Right.
Yes, don't touch it, Captain.
You'll get a shock. See, and this idea of they can't figure out a problem unless they're all part of it. They each have something to bring to the table. Kirk has his input, Spock has his, McCoy has his, and together, it's often been, I think, said in analysis of Star Trek is that really McCoy and Spock were two sides of Kirk's psyche.
Right.
One was the logic, the other one was the emotion. And he would always sit back and listen to see, to listen to the two debate with each other and then work out, find some middle ground and work out the problem in a way that wasn't reckless, nor was it cold. And that's what he does here.
Now we've entered into the red phase.
Remember this on video cassette? Just man, all it, red, it bleeding was, everywhere.
It looked frightening.
Yeah, I think video level standards have improved as technology has. We can now get a picture that's has much more latitude and can show us much more accurate to what a film originally looked like and what the artist originally went for. Now Kirk puts it together. See, he's listened to Spock and McCoy, and now he's put it together.
Well, I think this was one of the key parts of the script phase that Nimoy and Shatner contributed the most to, this
yes.
final solution.
I really love this moment here where Ilia pushes Kirk away.
Good timing.
See,
with the light,
and then
too.
Look at Steven's reaction. He looked up. You know, it's like he knows that she knows mm-hmm. that this is right, that this is what needs to happen. This is really an amazing concept. This is, you know, this movie essentially was 2001: A Space Odyssey with the Star Trek cast.
Yes.
And I think there was a lot of, people don't give it enough credit because can you take a very campy very inexpensively done TV series from the 1960s that really was considered a failure. And do those characters and that concept, can they hold their own in a science fiction story of the weight and importance of 2001: A Space Odyssey? And
right, will they stand up on that canvas?
Right, and it does. And this is an incredible concept of an intelligent machine that basically, you know, as Spock says, its knowledge spans the universe. If you really studied that phrase, you know, spans the universe, it's just mind-boggling. But yet, it can do nothing without a soul, basically.
Well, it's a theme that's inspired a tremendous amount of sci-fi as well. Mm-hmm.
But it's an essential human myth, right? It's like...
It's amazing how powerful and beautiful the sequence is.
And what is Jerry writing here musically? He's writing a big lovemaking scene.
Totally.
You know?
And this is like the, you know...
If you listen to just the music,
It's parts of a baby.
It's a romantic melody builds literally to, you know, a climax. You're actually standing there watching a new form of life, you know.
Guys, I think it's time to leave.
Yes, and they've been in this situation before. You get that sense that now you kind of needed this journey. Now it's Star Trek. Now it's Kirk, Spock, and McCoy having figured out the problem and getting their ass out of there, back to their ship. And, you know, this problem solved. What's next?
We added one shot in this using the original animation moiré patterns.
Right. Again, to be very clear with the geography, because abstract works to a degree, but at this point in the film, right at the climax, right there, you have to understand what's going on. And that physical existence of that vast vessel no longer matters. Vedder has evolved into this incredible consciousness that can't be contained anymore. And it goes off into its own plane of existence, you know, revealing the Enterprise, which is a microcosm in itself. It's a whole universe in and of itself, with now a family of characters who have figured out that they need each other and that they all belong right where they are. I mean, to people who love Star Trek, you face a lot of opposition to this film and not understanding what's going on. And yeah, it has some clunkiness to it, quite a bit of it. We worked with Bob Wise to smooth over as much of it as we possibly could, but that, to me, it's still there. That concept is still there. It's essential Star Trek, I would argue.
And this is talking about what we've just been through and the central core of the story, but it's also talking about Star Trek itself. It's the rebirth into a new form of Star Trek.
Again, another director might have gone very weepy with the moment where Scotty comes in and says, we can get you back to Vulcan. But, you know, Bob, in his own very clinical way, knows that it's enough to simply have Spock say, my task on Vulcan is completed. Therefore, he doesn't belong back on Vulcan, seeking total logic, out in a Vulcan monastery in the desert with his hair growing long. He belongs here. Nice theatrical moment, again, also bringing the few missing people back onto the bridge. There, Majel is Dr. Chapel and Scotty. And then right there, Kirk with Spock and McCoy standing behind him loyally. That's Star Trek. And again, that ending. It's like, it's not about, 457 Mark 329, whatever. It's just that away. It's about us. It's about the people. It's about we're going exploring. It's not about the technology, the machines. Those are our tools. That's what's going to get us there. We've gotten there because we've all worked together to get here. There's a lot of people, particularly politicians, who really should watch this movie, maybe even listen to our humble commentary, and figure that out. Figure out, you know, that we need to connect. And then maybe if we do, we can get to what we're seeing right here.
And we close it off with the stars as we began it.
And of course, that sums it all up right there.
At least not the pop that originally had on there. The last shot of the Enterprise going into warp, Doug Trumbull was telling us, was the bookending of the original shot that Dykstra did with the Klingons.
Right.
That John did that shot on his own with his group, and when Doug saw it, he's like, "Okay, well, you're going to do that. Where you know, I need something. I'm going to do something in the end with the Enterprise." And the fun little camaraderie, but the amazing results that came up there gave us two of the greatest shots that have been in any science fiction picture.
And it's funny, very early on here, when I was making my model of the movie Enterprise, I of course wanted to do, you know, shots from the movie to see if it worked. Mm-hmm. And of course, the first thing I did was try and recreate that ending shot of the Enterprise and light it mm-hmm. correctly and do all the wonderful things. And when we went to see Doug Trumbull,
right?
I showed it to him on my PowerBook, and he
was
said,
"Blown away!
Wow, that's it!" And that was really cool, and I'll never forget that.
It reminds me here, looking at the credits, that Alan Howarth was listed in here, and he was the guy who did Aaliyah's
processing on her voice.
And it was funny because we had basically one line, which is carbon units are not true life forms,
right.
Only the creator with and other similar life forms are true, that we needed recreated the same way. And our team just said, you know, it's such a difficult thing to get, let's go back to Alan Howarth. And we did, and he delivered four or five different versions of it. And it's just funny that we'd end up going back and...
He's a terrific electronic music specialist and well known for working with John Carpenter on his scores.
Yeah, Sid Mead's name in the original credits had an extra E on the end, and we fixed it.
Well, a few little things were fixed even in the credits. But there's, of course, a lot of people at Paramount who worked at the time and also when we did this project who deserve our gratitude for facilitating it. As we talked about earlier, we'd like to finish it, but particularly the people that managed the film, Waltz. They were just fantastic.
I want to mention a few. We had
Laura Thunberg.
Jeff Rodoyce was in charge, and we had Laura and we had Ron Smith.
Right.
And it was just, we couldn't have asked for a better group of people working with us to get this thing done.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a thrilling experience for Bob to be able to go back and finish it. It was always for him, it was like the one that got away. And, you know, he had always talked about that it was the only film that he had never previewed of 39 films. He then... his 40th was a Showtime film called A Storm in Summer, and then following that, he came back with us to Paramount and to finish Star Trek. And we mentioned the premiere that we had at the lot. That was extraordinarily gratifying to see him really, truly happy with the film, audience applauding it. The Hollywood Bowl performance we also mentioned was extraordinarily gratifying.
While we're on their names, let's mention the folks at Foundation Imaging here who did an amazing job with a very difficult job in a short amount of time. And of course, John O. and Ben Martin who helped Chuck with the sound.
Right.
And amazing job all around.
And even to today, you know, I couldn't have imagined two guys that I wouldn't...
Negative.
Could have done a better job with this. It's an honor working with you guys.
And that's our audio commentary for Star Trek The Motion Picture, The Director's Edition. Thanks for joining us. Please visit StarTrek.com for more exclusive features.